Welcome to What Are You Reading? A podcast dedicated to leadership development through a commitment to reading.
This is your host, Eugene Yang. This week, we're excited to sit down with John Tien. John Tien is a managing director at Citigroup and currently serves as the head of business transformation for a Citigroup business unit that annually generates more than $80 billion in sales and serves 86 million customers. He retired as a colonel from the United States Army after 24 years on active duty. He deployed on 3 combat tours in Iraq and has commanded armor branch units at the platoon, company, battalion, and task force levels. He also served on the National Security Council staff as a senior national security advisor to President Obama and President George W. Bush. He was selected for the White House Fellowship by the Clinton administration, where he served in the office of the United States Trade Representative. He is a 1987 graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point, where he was the first Asian American cadet to serve as first captain, the highest ranked cadet in his class. He received his master's degree from Oxford University, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar, and also studied at the Harvard Kennedy School as a National Security Fellow. He serves as the co-head of the Safe Salutes program, which supports military veterans and their families, and he's a board member for multiple foundations and nonprofits, including the Warrior Alliance, Vetlanta, the Schultz Family Foundation, and the Bob Woodruff Foundation. He also recently co-founded DiversityPod, a mobile app designed to grow the individual leadership quotient of any person through their own diversity discoveries. Sir, it's great to have you on the show with us today.
Great, thank you.
First question for you, what are you currently reading?
I'm reading actually 3 nonfiction books. I know that sounds pretty ambitious, but one I already had read before and I've come back to it. And then 2 others I've been reading really over the past year and a half. So the first book is a book called Tightrope by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. Tightrope by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. And that book, it came out, I think it was about a year and a half ago. And it's really a book talking about the transformation of the non-urban and rural populations that are out there in the smaller towns of mid-America, quite honestly, and the challenges that we're going through. There is an underlying current of the opioid epidemic and the challenges that go through. But the other sort of twin challenges that these populations or largely living outside the cities across America is the transformation of the American macroeconomy for them, right? Manufacturing, industry, and even more than just like coal mines. And, you know, because that's sort of the standard look when people think about, oh, rural America must be coal mines and farmers. But it's much, much larger than that. It's how those Americans are challenged now and how some are helping or overcoming not only the opioid crisis, but also really the transformation in the American economy. The second book I picked up really recently, this was about probably a month ago. It's a book called Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. Cast, C-A-S-T-E. And I say that so folks don't think, oh, it's cast like a Hollywood cast. No, it's really about the caste system. And it's about the stratification, usually on economic lines, but it's also demographic. And this scholar, Isabel Wilkerson, she's already a best-selling author. She came out with this book and she's really comparing what it's like for the challenge of Black Americans dating back since slavery, but all the way through the Jim Crow era and what many call the new Jim Crow era. The first reason I picked up Tightrope was because I could just see the challenges and the fracturing of America and the challenges of a set of population who really go overlooked, in my opinion. And I wanted to understand that population and all of their challenges, especially the opioid crisis and especially the transformation of the American economy and its impact on them. And then, look, I picked up Cast by Isabel Wilkerson to self-educate me on what it's like to be Black American. Fascinating book. And she does a really nice historical study between how the Nazis, quite honestly, evaluated and picked up and learned from how America had treated up until through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, because that's what Hitler was looking at, obviously, then, and then try to replicate that in many ways to how he treated the Jews in the 1930s and 1940s in Germany. And then in India is famous for its caste system and not necessarily in a very positive way. So to me, one of the reasons I put those two books side by side, I'm largely done with Tightrope, just started Cast, but we're at a challenging time for our country right now. This is a fracturing of the nation, a chasms that, as I've certainly haven't seen, and I think historically, if you look back, you probably have to walk back to the Civil War to find, I think, this much anger and rancor. So to me, this is about self-education on understanding populations that I think I kind of knew, but I certainly didn't fully understand. There's nothing like real experience to go out and understand those things that you don't know about. But the next best thing is, quite honestly, reading. And then the third piece, the third book, is a book I've picked back up. I had already read it once when it first came out, but I picked it back up at the beginning of COVID, which is No Ordinary Time by Doris Kearns Goodwin. No Ordinary Time by Doris Kearns Goodwin. Won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. And it's a book about America from 1939 to 1945. 1939 to 1945. And it's largely the two central characters are Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt. And many people tend to think of that book as, oh, it's a book about World War II and how great a president FDR was. But really what it's a book about is that FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt in 1939, so both almost co-equal leaders in many ways, even though FDR was the president, she was the first lady, in an America in 1939 was an America that was still in the Great Depression. It was still massively economically challenged. And if today we are in America that is maybe defined by two different parties, political parties, Democrats or Republicans, America in 1939 was, there were two big factions. There were those who had food and those who didn't have food, quite honestly, economically depressed, and those who were able to live in a living wage day to day. And then at the, let's call it at the national policy level, there were interventionists and isolationists. The interventionists and isolationists, those who really feared what was happening in Europe, in particular Nazi Germany and Hitler overtaking Poland and the Netherlands and then Paris, and then obviously threatening the United Kingdom. And then there were those who said, that has nothing to do with us. We have an ocean between us and we're trying to take care of what's here at the home front. So, you know, in many ways, as big a challenge, if not as existential as what we're seeing during the time of this pandemic crisis. So I picked it back up at the beginning of COVID because, again, I felt like I needed a re-baseline of what it's like to live when our society is in an existential crisis. We have two right now. We have the pandemic and we have what is, again, as I referred to, as a fracturing of America.
Sounds like some really, really good books to be reading right now. I'm curious. So rereading books has been kind of a theme amongst many of our guests on the show. When was the last time you read No Ordinary Time? And I guess what has changed either about yourself or in the second time picking it up? Really curious, like your thoughts on rereading. That's something that comes up a lot when we talk to senior leaders.
Let's talk a little bit about rereading in general. I generally don't reread books. What I will do is I will, before I refer a book to another person, let's say it's a junior officer, if it's a colleague, unless it's just in the moment, obviously. But if someone sends me an email or something says, hey, what's your recommendation for X for business leadership? Or if it's for military leadership, what I'll do is I'll pick it back up and I will do a bit of a random generation of I'll look at a particular chapter and I'll read a chapter. Right. And I'll go, oh, and then it does pull back. It goes into the, you know, filing cabinet of my brain. And what's nice about that is at least for me, it reinforces, oh, that's why I think that way. But, you know, potentially it was like, that's where I got that great thought that I've made my own. And there's nothing about that. You know, the famous line is imitation is the greatest form of flattery. It is taking other people's great ideas and insights and going and integrating it, not claiming it as your own, but integrating it into the way you approach things. No Ordinary Time, though, was very specific, as I said. I read it probably 15 years ago, and I specifically said I really thought through all of the different books. There are a fair amount of books about the 1918 Spanish flu, but they weren't really thinking about COVID, right? But I really felt like this is an existential global problem and challenge. How did America handle something like this? And I went back to World War II. And No Ordinary Time was so obvious. And it was really about national leadership, because at the end of the day, this is a monolithic issue that we're challenged by. It's one of those issues that is both micro and macro, even more than World War II. Although World War II and the Depression were micro to anybody who was either didn't have food in the Depression or was being drafted into the United States military.
Yeah. So shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about your career and balancing, you know, a lot of the scholarly pursuits that you had along the way. In terms of going on both efforts, so both lines of effort there, how did the two, you know, working in the operating forces and getting leadership and as well doing academic work and scholarly things, how did those two mutually support and how did they clash with one another?
Yeah, you know, Eugene, it's number one, I should say, because, you know, this is at some point, and who knows other than my mother who will listen to this podcast. But if for some reason one of my professors from West Point, Oxford, or Harvard happened to listen to this, they would have to have a bit of a chuckle and go, this is John Tien, right? What scholarly pursuits are we talking about here, right? And you might say, oh, you know, sir, I loved your feigned modesty here, but I will tell you that if you went and interviewed and did a podcast with any of my professors from West Point, Oxford, or Harvard, they would say, you know, he was a good student, but he really wasn't my best student. And I'm poking a little bit of fun at myself. My broader point here was I was a good student. West Point taught me how to grind, right? You do the reading assignments, you write your papers, you turn them in on time, and you study and you cram for your exams, and you'll survive on the other end. I mean, I happen to thrive, maybe just because I'm not a bad studier, but I'm not really a scholar necessarily. So I appreciate the word scholarly pursuit, but I want to be honest from the outset here. But turning this funny point into a serious point here, Eugene, is that what I am in any of those activities of which, and well, I think we're gonna talk about what I call the field army or the tactical army at some point. So we'll talk about that in a second. But when I stepped away from the field army and I had the opportunity to do what the army called, or at least used to call, broadening, I'm putting in air quotes here, broadening opportunities. What I did was I did my scholarly part. I turned in on my assignments and I certainly educated through the structured education system, wherever it was, West Point, Oxford, White House Fellowship, Harvard Kennedy School, was I'm a champion club joiner. Right. I am a champion team joiner, activities person. And I don't do it just to like put it on my activity sheet or my resume, because at some point people really don't look at your activity sheet anymore. But I do it because to me, where education, I learned this pretty early on at West Point, quite honestly, was at least for me, and it's the kind of learner I am and the kind of world and global citizen I am. I learn by exposing myself and engaging with those who are not like me, right? Who are smarter than me, who come from different parts of the world than me, who have different interests than me, and hopefully they learn from me as well in some ways. But that engagement, that hand-to-hand, that elbow-to-elbow engagement, the sometimes sparring back and forth over whatever those topics are, that's where I get, selfishly, I learn the most, but I also enjoy the most. And so just again, scholarly pursuits, it was really a combination of scholarly pursuits and also engagement pursuits in these worlds that are different from the place where if you were to stay on just a purely tactical path within the military. The other reason I did that was because I view these opportunities. I was very fortunate for the Army to let me go teach at West Point, let me go serve in the Clinton administration as a White House fellow, let me go to the Harvard Kennedy School, and let me do some things that were different from the field army. Well, it's because the Army and the military are going to make sure that you're tactically competent, that you're going to meet your tactical competencies, right? We are really good at the quarterly project plan, and you're going to hit all your gates, and you're going to qualify on tank table 8 or naval gunnery or whatever it is. And I trust the military implicitly on that. We are the best military in the world and probably the best military in history, that, you know, my own opinion. So when you have those opportunities to step away from that, knowing that you're fully tactically competent, that's when I would exercise my brain, because the other thing that the military, in my opinion, wanted me to be was a agile thinker, a thoughtful leader, and a diverse citizen of the world, right? So someone who could see things in a much broader way, because there would come a time where they were going to ask me, and it happened in Iraq when I commanded a battalion in combat, where I was going to be dealing on a literally hour-to-hour basis with people who didn't look like me at all. And these were the Sunni, Shia, and Turkmen sheikhs. And had, and I think, at least for me, some people think I had a successful battalion command as part of the Al Anbar Awakening, and well, first up in Talafer and then Al Anbar Awakening down in Ramadi in 2006 and 2007, that we were successful as a unit because of my ability to deal my role in all of that, my share of the task, as General McChrystal called his book, My Share of the Task, was to really be the person who was engaging with these civil and quite honestly pseudo-military leaders called the sheikhs, the warlords in both Talafer and Ramadi. And I think because I had exercised my brain and it approached my time away from the field army, developing and evolving my sense of understanding the broader world, I think that helped me quite a bit. So that's where the mutual support came in. The clash, it never, I know, and I certainly know I have some friends who had some of the clash of, you know, there's some very famous cases where, oh, that officer or non-commissioned officer didn't get promoted because he or she, you know, was too bookish or whatever. Hmm. That actually never happened to me. And I think one of the reasons was the army, at least for the conventional army, I was an armored officer. They actually wanted you to step away about every 5-7 years for those broadening opportunities. So, you know, good on the military, the army for doing it. I don't know if they're still doing that, but culturally, I really never felt that clash. I think one of the reasons was also is because when I was doing the field army, I went all in, much the way when I was at Harvard, let's say, I went all in on both the scholarly pursuits, but also the activity pursuit, the you know, leading seminars and things of that nature when I was at Harvard, on counterinsurgency, by the way, leading a seminar. But when I was in the field army, I went all in. Case in point was in the year 2000, I went to the National Training Center by choice. And that's our big maneuver warfare training center in the Mojave Deserts, the size of Rhode Island, tank on tank battle. It looks like just desert with big mountains, a lot like Afghanistan. I could have done a bunch of different things, maybe more cooler things like go back to Germany. But I chose Fort Orr and the National Training Center because there you get to do 75% of the time in the field versus, let's say, going to Fort Polk where you only get to, or Fort Hood where you only get to spend 25% of the time. So I think because when I was able to hone my tactical skills as a maneuver warfare commander, so to speak, I maxed it out and hopefully did well enough. So when the promotion boards and those who were my commanding officers said, yep, guy happens to be smart, but he's a pretty good war fighter as well.
Hmm. Yeah. I do want to follow up and ask, it sounds like what you're saying is, sure, there is the, you know, you show up to write this paper or take these classes, sit in these study groups, but then the engagement outside, kind of the extracurriculars, if you will, that is a huge value add in terms of actually giving you the ability and setting you up for success to deal with different people and different groups. How do you think that is different now, given COVID? Some of our listeners are, you know, in the Fleet Scholars Program or at Naval Postgraduate School and maybe unable to join some of these clubs or activities. What would your recommendation be for those folks to get that same broadening experience in engaging people that are different from them and learning how other people see different perspectives and have different interests in kind of the virtual COVID environment we're in right now?
Yeah, I think one of the things that COVID or the pandemic crisis, and this is true about a lot of different things, but we'll zero in on, you know, a more narrow subset of things, is things like this, right? Where Zoom is just prevalent. It's become a verb. It's a noun and a verb. Yeah. And I don't think that's going to stop. I think when the vaccine comes, not if, but when the vaccine comes and we are back to where, you know, getting on airplanes and going in person to a reception or a place where you could see, I think those things will still happen. But I also think that people, this is going to make it so much more commonplace for you to say, hey, you know, I'd love for you to meet, just, you know, a one-to-one networking via email. I'd love for you to link up with this person. I think you guys would really get along and learn from each other. And in the old days, at best, so pre-COVID is the old days, is at best, you'd get on a phone call. at worst is, you're in DC. Well, next time I'm in DC, let's, put ourselves on there. And then it was sort of hit and miss. Whereas I think the Zoom opportunity and the prevalence of the video conference will bring people closer together. It's still two dimensional, but it is, I do think, increases the opportunity quite a bit. So my recommendation would be whether, while we're in COVID now, certainly do the Zoom and stay safe and stay as self-isolating as you can, is to, anytime you get the opportunity to meet somebody else, go right to the video conference, right? And don't take the easy path or, hey, look, yes, you got to shave. You don't even have to put, no one expects you to wear a, I haven't taken my gray blazer out of my closet for 7 months. So that's that's the first thing is go to Zoom or video conference versus a phone call. I think the other thing, though, is, and this is no different than pre-COVID, at least for me, which is you have to be proactive to your engagement of a network that won't just happen on its own. So you can't just allow yourself, and this is my broader point here, which is you don't, maybe beyond your question a little bit, you can't just allow yourself to network in a linear fashion. Because if that happens, what you'll do is you will still stay in what I call an intellectual comfort zone. You won't get that broadening effect. And by broadening doesn't mean diversity for diversity's sake. It's diversity for intellectual stimulation's sake. And it's going to make you a more agile thinker. You're going to have to think about things in a different way because you want to be an equal partner, or at least as much as you can be in the particular conversation. And again, by definition, if you just stay within your own clubhouse, so to speak, the conversations you're going to have are probably just going to be variants of the same conversation over and over again. So force yourself, and even when you go back into the field, Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, or Coast Guard, even then, look for those opportunities again, because Zoom being so prevalent and video conference being so prevalent, expand your network and make it as rich as possible by engaging in conversations you normally wouldn't have if you just went into your backyard and had a barbecue with the folks you normally have a barbecue with.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. So we kind of talked today a little bit about leading through change, right? So big changes, talking about World War II, talking about COVID. What I'd like to ask is your experience being in the military while it was going through a big change. So when you joined the military, we were focused on the Cold War, and then we started to shift emphasis towards the Middle East, and you went to combat in the Middle East multiple times, both in conventional operations and counterinsurgency operations. What was your experience personally going through that organizational change? What did you see in the leaders? What did you need to do as a leader? And what helped prepare you for going through that experience?
The biggest shift, definitely, there were two shifts in my military career. There was the Cold War, and then there was the post-Cold War, right? That was interesting. And for a long time, I would, if someone asked me a question like the one you just asked, I would talk about how interesting it was to serve a border tour on the border between Western Germany and Czechoslovakia in 1989. And then literally a year later, being able to drive across that same border, where before I would have been shot, quite honestly, by the Czechoslovakian border guards, into Leipzig, Germany. And it was crazy. It was mind-blowing. But that was certainly perestroika and glasnost and the fall of the Berlin Wall. But much more jarring, as it turns out, was the post 9/11 transformation from an entirely conventional army where we were fighting those big maneuver warfare, and that's what we were preparing ourselves for, to some extent, still fighting the last war of okay, we got to be prepared because somebody might call us on tank-on-tank warfare, and then shifting into counterinsurgency. I will say this about the United States Army leadership at the time, post 9/11, and once we intervened in Afghanistan and then intervened in Iraq to achieve our then national security objectives, was their willingness to acknowledge that we weren't prepared, that we were not ready for the counterinsurgency fight. We had some remnants and an intellectual residue, so to speak, from having been in the Balkans on patrols and other things. But the Army, if anything, at the end of the day, at least for me, said, yep, we were charged to win our nation's wars. The war we're in right now is not conventional. It's going to be counterinsurgency. And so for me, they turned to me very quickly as, now I'm just saying individually, I'm not saying they called on me to be the savior or anything, but they turned to me and said, hey, look, you're going to be a battalion commander in combat, maybe in Afghanistan, probably in Iraq, given the direction that we're going. So here, every job that I got, and I didn't even have to seek it. Every job that I got between the time 9/11 happened to time I deployed my unit in combat in early 2006 was all about then training me as a counterinsurgent. I think it went pretty well. I mean, I'll give you two really interesting examples. One was the Israelis reached out to us before we went into Iraq. So this was 2002 and said, you Americans have never really fought a counterinsurgency war. You're about to do it in the Middle East here in Iraq. Why don't you send over a cohort of officers, like in a train the trainer approach? And so I was chosen to lead that from the national training. We took our top maneuver warfare training center folks. I happened to be in the leadership at that time. And I led a team of about 15 majors and lieutenant colonels over to Israel. And they taught us everything they knew about counterinsurgency. It was fascinating.
Wow.
And then we brought it back and we created a field manual. And I think, it came in pretty handy. I certainly used it throughout and drew on that. The other thing, though, was much more on an institutional at the post-installation level, was we turned the National Training Center in about 6 months. It looked like the Khazarine Pass in North Africa, Rommel Patton type of stuff. It was size of Rhode Island. I talked about it earlier. And it was desert tank-on-tank warfare. Within 6 months, we turned it into essentially the road from Kuwait to Baghdad. And we trained the 3rd Infantry Division on what their maneuver, what their approach march was going to be, their axis of advance was going to look like in terms of city, in terms of people. We hired, there's a fairly big, I never knew it, there's a fairly big Arabic-speaking population down in San Diego. And we went to them, and I was at that time, I was, a planner, a war planner, but also I turned into a bit of a logistics officer where they said, all right, here's a contract. Go sign a statement of work. And people were in these great Arab Americans came out and they said, yes, we would love to role play. And we turned the National Training Center into a mini Iraq to prepare the 3rd Infantry Division, both tactically, what they would see in terms of counter, insurgent attacks, but also culturally. And then myself, when I went to Germany, I was given that same opportunity to train in similar makeshift towns. In the middle of Germany, in Hohenfels, Germany. So I really give it to the Army. They pivoted pretty quickly, and they kept it sustained. The question now for today's forces is, and I am by no means an expert, so I'm only going to spend two sentences on this, is I think it's probably equally jarring to be led and to be so populated by those folks like me, who, especially senior leaders now, who grew up in counterinsurgency, who now are facing, what does it mean to be getting ready to fight the next war. Is it going to be with China? Is it going to be with Russia? And what kind of battlefields will it be? Again, I would go back to what I said before is, look, the Army's going to train you and the Navy's going to train you, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Air Force is going to train you on what they think is best. Go through that training. Got to trust the leadership. But for you as an individual, go into a place where you have intellectual discomfort, because it's going to make you a more agile thinker.
Yeah, leaning into, what does this mean for us now and junior leaders? I think the big takeaway for us is, we should be pushing ourselves out of our bubble, getting out of the echo chamber, finding intellectual diversity, learning something new. Yeah, and again, right, not just for diversity's sake. On the topic of diversity, earlier this year, you spoke on the 4Block podcast with Mike Abrams and talked about your motivation for joining the military as a first-generation American. You were the first Asian-American cadet brigade commander at West Point. Can you talk a little bit about your experience as an Asian-American serving in the Army for over 24 years?
It was interesting. When I grew up, yes, I was first-generation Chinese-American, but I grew up largely as an American. Right? We went to McDonald's. I played 3 sports in high school. I played Little League baseball and lived in some fairly diverse neighborhoods, except for one for about 4 years, very non-diverse. I was literally the only person of color in a high school of 2,000 people, along with my sister. But I generally thought of myself, I was American, right? So when I went to West Point, the same thing. West Point at that time was incredibly, in my opinion, culturally very inclusive. And I really never felt like, I'm an Asian American, or that he or she over there is, a Black American or Hispanic. But when I was made when they chose me as first captain, and I had good grades, and I was certainly a a decent cadet athlete and a decent cadet leader. So I felt like, oh, okay, this makes sense. You know, I looked at my peers and I said, yeah, we all have about the same scores. And I think we're all pretty good cadet leaders. But when I was made the first captain, someone said to me pretty quickly, you know, you're the first Asian American first captain. And I said, well, I was thinking, wow, this is such a big deal. I mean, I'm going to be taking on the role that Douglas MacArthur had, that William Westmoreland had, that John Pershing had. I mean, these are four-star generals. This is crazy. But then someone said, you're the first Asian American. And at that time, there had been a Hispanic American first captain and a Black American first captain. And they were about 5 and then 10 years before me. The Hispanic American, I think, in the late 70s, and the Black American in 1980s, Vince Brooks, who goes on to be a four-star general and a great mentor of mine. But at any rate, I was like, yep, I guess that's different. But then I didn't do anything with it because I just said, look, I'm going to be just a great first captain. If I happen to be the great a great Asian American first captain, then so be it. But first, I need to concentrate on just being the best first captain I can be.
Yeah.
When it really hit home, though, was I was in a I was called down to the superintendent's house on a weekend, and he said, "Hey, I want you to meet these." It was Lieutenant General Palmer said, "Meet these officers from the People's Republic of China," and they all had all these stars and ribbons, and they didn't speak English, and I didn't speak Mandarin Chinese, but they said immediately, and I'll cut the story kind of short here, is blah 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 blah, back and forth, and then we asked them, General Palmer and I asked them, well, what did they say? And they said, wow, this West Point is in the Army is such a meritocracy that at the United States Military Academy, just a decade since Vietnam, that a Chinese American can be the number one cadet at West Point. This is a meritocracy. This is a true profession of arms. And this is how we need to be in the People's Republic of China Army. And I thought, oh, I'm glad to have had that impact, right? You know, I'm glad to have an impact. And then I would say, you know, really over the course of my career, I didn't feel as if being having a different skin color or being a Chinese American was really impacting either for good or for bad. I really didn't ever feel like there was a diversity play whenever I was selected for things. Maybe it was happening, but certainly not in terms of how I was treating. That's one of the reasons I really like the United States military, is that it is a true meritocracy in its aspiration. Now, in its practice, at the end of the day, the military, just the way they are introspective when it comes to getting ready for war, I think today's military and the military I was in needs to be constantly introspective and self-evaluating, saying, are we practicing what we preach? Is it still a true meritocracy? And in terms of systems, do we have systems in place that will actually say, well, you know, if you have 10% Asian Americans coming in or 10% making their way through the ranks, and if not, to ask yourself, why is that? You know, because if we're basing it based on non-color-based or gender-based elements and it's purely on merits, then it should be happening in a natural progression.
So recently you co-founded Diversity Pop, a mobile app designed to grow individual leadership through people going through a diversity discovery. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how that can be useful, especially in our current environment as we understand diversity from different people's perspectives and use that to help us cope with change and get ahead of change and become that kind of agile thinker?
Yeah, sure. Definitely. It's pretty new. It's Diversity Pop. So diversity, the word diversity, and then POP, P-O-P. And it's going to be a mobile app. It's going to be both on, you know, the iPhone and on Android as well. We're rolling it out over the next really couple of weeks. You know, this is, let's call it the fall, just early fall of 2020. So excited that at some point it will show up on people's phones by choice and certainly by opportunity. Let me start first with the reason that I got involved with this, and I am a co-founder. There are 11 other co-founders who actually I think are much smarter than me and much more engaged and involved than me. But, you know, hopefully I had some contribution to it along the way. And we definitely have a big leader in it, and Drew Barkowitz, who runs something called Patriot Apps. But the reason that I wanted to get involved with it was because of some of the things I talked about earlier in this podcast, which is I have found that at least over my time, my career, both in the military and or in the military and the White House and certainly the private sector, that I learn the most from other people who are different than me. I learn the most from other people who are different than me. And I'm not talking about gender or sexual identity or even veteran or non-veteran. It's all of those things, but it's literally how are they different than me? That's where I gain the most knowledge. And I, quite honestly, I gain the most self-actualized self-discovery, right, when I've engaged in those folks. And what Drew and my fellow co-founders have found that, number one, so much of our lives are spent, if you think about the device that we spend so much time with, it is literally our smartphones. Economically, it does stratify to some extent because you have to have enough money to afford a smartphone, but not everybody needs an iPhone 11, but there are smartphones in the app technology. It's everywhere. So we said, this is where we need to engage folks and meet them where they live in terms of saying, do you have the opportunity to really think through how many times you get to connect with people who not even don't look like you, but more importantly, don't think like you, right?
Right.
In different places. So you could say, well, that's called LinkedIn, John, right? You know, go on LinkedIn, not necessarily Facebook, because that tends to be a bit of a, you know, echo chamber for most people, but in LinkedIn, right? But what you don't tend to do is have conversations through LinkedIn. You network through LinkedIn. But through Diversity Pop, the idea behind this is it's really a training tool to say to somebody, all right, let's take you through a self-examination, a self-discovery of how diverse of a thinker really are you, right? And then when you're not, where are the opportunities for each of us as individuals? Where are those gaps? And then once you recognize, to me, self-awareness, we haven't talked about a lot about leadership here, but one of my big things is self-aware, right? Is what are those gaps that you have? And then if you're a good leader, or if you care to be a good leader, or let's say even a better person, you seek to close those gaps. That's what this app is going to aim to do.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely have to check it out. So last question for you. Can you talk a little bit about your transition from a military career in all sorts of different environments into executive management in the private sector? And what were some of the largest cultural differences or maybe surprises that you had to adjust to that maybe you weren't prepared for, or you weren't prepared for the degree to which they'd be different compared to your military time?
Yeah, I'll start off with sometimes when I get asked this question, Eugene, you know, folks are looking for a template for how to do it. And I work a lot of my, what I would call spare time. You know, the one nice thing about once you get out of the military is you can join any club you want. You know, so I'm Mr. Club Joiner, Mr. Team Joiner, Mr. Activity Guy, Citigroup in my case, you know, gave me a entree in different platform to really speak in a louder voice. There's a lot of freedom here. And then I also realized being a managing director, essentially in the top 2% of a big Fortune 30 company, and to give more of a bullhorn to the causes that I cared about. And the causes I really care about are taking care of our military veterans and our military family members, to especially our military spouses. Why? Because, you know, that's the experience I came from. And I saw that not only were there challenges for military veterans as they got out of the military, but definitely for military spouses who don't get near the amount of credit. You know, my wife, Tracy, doesn't get near amount of the credit for supporting me and for being, you know, at least in her case, the family readiness group when I was in Iraq, and she had no idea whether I was coming back or any of our 1,100 soldiers, many of whom had families that she was the caretaker for. So I said, how do I give back to them? So that's one cool thing about going into the private sector, and especially with a company like Citi, who's incredibly positively supportive of active military veterans and military spouses. And really, right now, I get to help co-lead their Citi Salutes program. So that's one cool thing about going to the private sector. You were asking about the transition. Well, for me, there's not a pure template for me because of, you know, I guess, quite honestly, my experience was pretty unique. But what I can tell, and what I often tell veterans as they're thinking, as they active military members or National Guard and Reserve who are looking to transition, is two things. One is oftentimes that it's better to be lucky than good. It's better to be lucky than good. I say it's better to be lucky and good. And I'll get to that in a second as a teaching point. And then the other thing I say is to really take stock of what the military has trained you to do and then to go through a series of steps that help you translate that both in words and in behavior to when you start to interview and have conversations with people who are like, oh, I would love to, you know, bring you in. So the lucky part is that the vast majority, let's just take America, right? The vast majority of American companies, to include Citigroup, have an open door to veterans for the interview or for what I would say the application, right? We all have employee resource groups, business resource groups. For us, we call it City Salutes, right, here at Citigroup. But that's just one part of it. That's sort of the lucky part in that they have the open door. The good part is that's you, that's your job, right? You're going to have to demonstrate through your translation, your self-aware translation of what you did in the military to what you might be able to bring to that particular private sector. And quite honestly, it starts with choosing the right profession in the first place. And I think a lot of this has to go back to, as a friend of mine says, you have to have some cups of tea and some coffees and some friend breakfast, probably through Zoom, usually through phone calls, if you can get it through at a local diner with three or four other veterans who have walked in your shoes before. I really like a veterans transition program, mentoring program called Veterati. So it's like Veterati, started by a great Marine, Daniel Rao. And it allows you to go in and both the mentor and the mentee to choose an hour or a couple hours a month. And you can just get that initial grounding to help you do the translation, but also for you to start to change your context for how you think about the outside world. So for me, I was both lucky and good, and I had a really incredible network to bring me in. But the luck was I had a great network, but the good was that I figured out how to translate those things I had done as a tactical battalion commander in combat, small unit leadership, courage under fire, leading, bringing together great and diverse people in the course of achieving a singular objective, i.e. securing and stabilizing places like Talofer and Ramadi in Iraq and supporting and defending our Constitution of the United States. And then also the other parts of my career in the military to include my three tours at the White House, and in particular, managing global risk for one of President Obama's biggest policy objectives, which was to bring security and stability to the countries of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for your time and thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
No, it's a pleasure and an honor.
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading? A podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, what are you reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week.